LinuxQuestions.org presents LQ Radio, the number one online radio broadcast focusing on Linux and open source. And now, LQ Radio, open talk about open source.
Hello, and welcome to the third installment of the LQ Radio interview series. Today, I have with me Asa Dotzler of the Mozilla Foundation. Welcome, Asa.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jeremy.
Yep. Not sure if you are aware, Asa, but you have your own Wikipedia entry. So I'm going to read...
Yeah, I actually saw that not too far back. There was some questions from a couple of reporters to Raphael here in the Foundation, who handles PR, asking for some biographical information on me or information about my position at Mozilla, and he suggested they go check out the Wikipedia entry, which caused it to sort of pop up in my head, so I went and checked it out. It was kind of surprising. I got home that night and showed my wife. She was amused, but immediately went about correcting a couple of errors in it, and I see now that it's actually quite active. There are people going in and adding to it when a new piece of popular discussion comes about, like my recently slash-dotted blog post on Linux and the desktop. Those get added as featured articles, and it's pretty exciting. I feel like a minor celebrity in that Mozilla world now.
Yeah, that's how you know you made it big time, is when you have your own Wikipedia entry. So I'm going to read just the first paragraph as kind of an intro for those of the listeners that aren't familiar with you.
All right.
Asa Dotzler is best known for his work on Mozilla, in addition to being the QA lead, including community quality advocate for the project. Dotzler is also the Firefox and Thunderbird product release manager, and he's Mozilla's community marketing coordinator. He joined Mozilla.org to turbocharge their quality programs and to further develop their volunteer QA and testing community. When he's not helping new contributors test Mozilla and report bugs, he's working with drivers at Mozilla.org to define requirements for and ship Mozilla product releases. So beyond that, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got into open source in general, and then specifically how you came to work for the Mozilla Foundation?
Sure. Actually, that's a little bit outdated now. Things are moving pretty quickly in Mozilla land, so I can tell you a little about where I've moved on from some of those tasks and taken on some new ones. But about 6 years ago, I started my sort of formal volunteer involvement with the Mozilla project. That was about a year after they released the source code, and I had some friends in college. I was in an architecture program, actually, and I had some friends in college that were big Linux users back in the mid-90s before it sort of took off in the, at least in the mainstream press and in the popular computing world. And they were very enthusiastic about Linux and open source. I was really quite interested in open source, but at the time, being a Macintosh user, was having great difficulty accepting the Linux desktop as anything I might use. A couple years after I met them and sort of got my introduction to what open source was, Netscape announced that they would be open sourcing their Communicator web browser suite, and I sort of popped up and said, hey, there's a product I actually do use. Is going to be open source, something that I've been enthusiastic about getting involved with. Let me see if I can insinuate myself into that. And so I went about trying to find a way to get involved. For the first few months after the source code release, there weren't any binaries available. You had to be a developer, and you had to have the kit to be able to pull the source code and build it before you could use it or test it. And so I was sort of out of luck.
Okay.
Not long after I sort of gave up on my initial quest, a couple of websites, Mozilla Zine and a site then called Mozbin, which not long after that folded in with Mozilla Zine, started publishing the locations of FTP repositories that would have random developer builds posted. So I could start downloading those and testing them and got into reporting bugs in Bugzilla. And that was really my initial plunge into open source and Mozilla involvement. After a couple of months of reporting bugs, I realized that I was getting pretty good at it. The developers had plenty of time to tell me what was useful and what wasn't useful. And we were starting to see a big ramp up in the number of people who were testing builds and reporting bugs to Bugzilla. a good portion of those were not very useful to developers, and it seemed to me that developers were starting to be a bit overwhelmed by a lot of low quality or bug reports without enough information to be acted on. So I took it on myself to start communicating with those bug reporters and telling them how they could improve their reports. Pretty soon, people started turning to me for how to get involved with Mozilla testing and bugs. That's my real introduction to the project. I'd say a year of doing that, Mozilla.org, a virtual entity that was funded primarily by the Netscape, then AOL organizations, offered me a job and told me I could move out to California and become a full-time employee and get paid to continue doing this coordination work. That was a wonderful opportunity. I, of course, seized it. Here was something I was putting about 30 hours a week into as a volunteer, and they were going to pay me to do it.
That's
sort of
like,
hey, if you're a golfer and someone says, you know, we'd love to pay you to golf, you'd probably jump right on them. So I did. My wife, Deanna Pierce, and I moved out to California, and I became an employee at Netscape, charged with maintaining and coordinating the Mozilla open source QA and testing effort. Over the years, that evolved into helping get releases out the door, which meant some project planning, some release management, and finally sort of final QA on our release builds. That continued to evolve into more project planning responsibilities. I joined a group called Drivers at Mozilla.org, which laid out the development. And then the Firefox project. And that sort of changed some of my roles within the project. Blake Ross, Dave Hyatt, Brian Reiner, Joe Hewitt, and myself, maybe one or two others, Ian Hickson, were sitting around an IRC complaining about some of the silly decisions that Netscape's marketing group was putting into how they were going to develop the Netscape browser, which was based on Mozilla code, and we saw that they were adding all kinds of marketing-driven features that weren't particularly useful to the end user. And we sat down to see if we could make a lightweight, fast Zool browser that would demonstrate that not only was the Mozilla platform and Zool a great language to work in, but that you could build a competitive product with that that would satisfy a lot broader audience than what Mozilla was reaching. That did pretty well, and when the Mozilla Foundation formed 2 years ago, not long after, it became quite obvious that we were going to shift over to Firefox and the standalone Thunderbird email application as our primary focus, and I got involved with product design and planning for the eventual Firefox 1.0 release, continued doing QA and community coordination, and then right up as we were getting close to the preview release of Firefox 1.0, Blake Ross and I started to put together a program to do some evangelism, outreach, marketing, and that very quickly turned into Spread Firefox, which has since grown up to be about 115,000 users strong and made quite a bit of press on its own with the New York Times ad campaign, our march to 10 million, and currently is the focus of our community outreach and marketing project. So my job has gone from being a tester as a volunteer to being a testing coordinator to being a paid employee to coordinate various pieces of our open source community and managing releases to now doing open source marketing. So it's really hard to put a label on what I do. I think my next business card is going to say not a developer, because that's pretty much the only thing I don't do around here.
Okay. Kind of in the description, you mentioned a few different operating systems. Right now, what's your OS of choice?
I use Windows primarily, but being that I am responsible for shipping high-quality products on Mac, Windows, and Linux, in addition to another dozen or so second-tier platforms, in my days on Mac, Windows, and Linux, I have about 5 machines. My Windows machine runs VMware, and I have 6 or 7 Linux distributions running inside of that, along with a couple of other Windows installs running inside of that. I've got 2 Macintoshes, one that runs OS 10.1, 2, 3, and 4, and another that's the Mac on Intel developer kit where I'm running the latest version of the operating system. And I have a standalone Linux testing box that I install a new distro on about once a week. But I am primarily using Windows, and when I'm spending time on Linux, it's either on my standalone box or in one of my VMware installs.
Okay. And how's OS X run on that Intel box?
Oh, it's just fast. Out of curiosity. And Firefox is fast. Josh Hose, who's our sort of lead Firefox on Mac developer, has been working to get native Firefox up and running outside of the emulation layer, actually running on the new Mac on Intel platform. And he gives me development builds about once a week that I play with, and they are blazing fast. It's
awesome.
It's awesome. I have nothing but the highest of hopes for this new platform. If it's anything, you know, if it progresses over the next year the way, you know, the Intel hardware platform has been progressing over the last couple of years, then performance and apps like Firefox and any questions about their performance are going to be a thing of the past, because this is a blazing fast system. And Firefox, I mean, you can hit Control N to open up new windows and just hold that key down and watch, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 windows show up on screen, all populated with the content in a matter of seconds.
Oh, nice.
It's beautiful.
Great. So on the release side, you guys recently decided to scrap the planned 1.1 release, and instead you're going to release you're calling it 1.5, and the post that I saw mentioned that it was due to the significant number of bug fixes and changes that you thought bumping it up 0.1 wasn't really indicative of the development that had been done. Is that Deer Park release still on target for the September-ish milestone, and what can we expect from the release?
We've been in a fairly long development cycle here with the post 1.0 release. When we shipped 1.0, we immediately made a commitment to a quick follow-up release, which we hoped would be taking all of the Firefox 1.0 feature set and landing it onto, it was on this stable development branch and had been for about 6 months. And so the goal was to land it onto the tip of our development tree and pick up a whole bunch of really good back-end changes in our Gecko rendering technologies and our networking libraries and all of that. We landed the Firefox 1.0 code base onto the development tip and picked up some good stability and performance and security fixes, and also started to undertake improvements to our feature set with the idea that we might turn something around in April, March or April. We got into March and April, and by that time had received enough feedback on 1.0. We'd also shipped a couple of security updates for 1.0 and realized that our update infrastructure, which is both client software and server-side stuff, just was not capable of handling the enormous volume of traffic that we were experiencing. I think that all of us had great hopes that we would see, you know, millions of downloads of Firefox, but none of us really anticipated in our wildest dreams that come March that we would have, you know, tens of millions of people ready to, you know, to take advantage of that update service, and it just architecturally couldn't that kind of load. It was just not robust enough, and we decided we needed a world-class update system because it's critical that we be able to offer our users both security updates and feature and new release updates in a timely and convenient fashion, what they come to expect from their OS update systems. So we began work in March and April to build a better update infrastructure, and quickly realized that that was going to be significant enough undertaking that we wouldn't be able to do that simple, let's get Firefox 1.0 landed on the Gecko Trump turnaround and ship it. And at that point, we made a decision to move our release out to the summer. And we'd been telling people that this was going to be a 1.1 release, thinking it was really just going to be, you know, picking up some new Gecko backend changes. But by April, May, June, we were already saying this really is a lot more than what we intended to do when we named the thing 1.0 back in November, December. Mm-hmm. Sorry, named it 1.1. And there was a lot of internal discussion about this really isn't what we had planned for 1.1 anymore. This is a much more significant release. Given the long pole that we had of getting this updating system working and knowing that that was going to take us into the summer, we also decided during that time, the people who weren't working on the update feature, we'd let them go ahead and start tackling some new features and implementing new capabilities with Firefox. So when we hit, you know, June and early July, it became very clear to us now that we no longer had that small 1.1 update. We had a real serious feature update primarily with the focus around our application and extension update system, but also with new features like tab drag and drop for reordering. We had an entirely new options and preferences service and UI. We added a top-level menu for clearing your tracks or moving your cookies and passwords and history and all of that. And so we're moving the goalposts as we worked on the update system. And by the time we got into the middle of this month, it became very clear that we couldn't call this 1.1. It would be a disservice to tell our users that this is just a minor update. You know, maybe you don't need it, because the truth is this is a very large update, and we encourage all of our users to get it because it is just that much better. Right. So we sat down and had a meeting and said, is this really 1.1, and decided it wasn't. It was something more than that, but it wasn't quite 2.0 either, because we had a set of features that we anticipated including in 2.0, and we weren't there yet. So it seemed to make a lot of sense to just call it 1.5, say we're about halfway to the 2.0 mark, and make this a something of a more serious new release for our tens of millions of users out there. Okay. As far as the date we expect to hit, this is a tricky thing. We use dates not to announce to the press or even to our users when the next release is going to be available. We're an open source project, and we have people contributing from all over the world, and we at times need to get them all focused on some targets for when we're going to wrap up pieces of work. And so we announce to our developer community and to our testing community that we'd like to have something wrapped up around this time to get us all sort of focused on the same goal.
Sure.
That's not saying that we're going to be date-based, and if we get there and it's not ready, we're going to ship it. So our current thinking is that we would like to have something out in September. And we want everyone to be focused on that so that we can try to achieve September. But if we get there and the release is not of the quality, and if the features that we have are not up to the level of functionality that we want, we're not going to ship, because we ship software when it's ready, not when some arbitrary date passes. So I do hold high hopes that we're going to get something out in September. I'd like to start moving on to the 2.0 work as soon as possible, because we've got some really exciting stuff coming up there. But we are shooting for a September release of this 1.5. And I think it's also worth noting that it's not so much that we scrapped 1.1, or that we had a 1.1 that was ever done and we tossed it over to go do a 1.5. We basically learned in February and March, with the need for a new update system, that simple 1.1 wasn't going to happen, and that we didn't announce to the press back then that 1.1 was just a placeholder name. It caused us a little bit of confusion, but I think that basically what happened is 1.1 grew into 1.5 in a very organic and necessary way, and now we do understand what we're going to be including in that, and it does feel to us like a 1.5, so that's what we're going to call it.
Okay. That's one of the nice things about open source, is you can usually dictate releases by quality and readiness, not when marketing says you have to get it out the door.
Yeah, and we do have some concerns there. For example, there are a lot of companies now that are building projects or building out infrastructure that are going to work on Firefox. So if you've got an extended developer, someone like a Yahoo or a Google who are developing a toolbar, tell them you're going to have something ready for them. They're going to line up their schedules around that. If you've got a company like IBM that's going to roll out Firefox to potentially a couple hundred thousand users, tell them when you're going to have the next release available for them. It's nice to be as close to that as you can, or to be in regular communication with them to let them know, your schedule is changing some. So as we get larger, I think it'll be more important that we get better at defining goals, and when we can't make those schedules, more clear and up front, so that it doesn't come down to the end game and look like we've shifted everything out, but that people see our schedule evolving.
Okay.
And that's just, if you want to ship high quality products, you cannot be purely date driven. And again, you can't toss dates out the door and hope to ever. Yeah, so I was saying that, you don't want to be date driven, but at the same time, I think it's important to get people focused on bringing a release together, and that requires some dates. You can't just say, we're going to ship it when it's ready, and everyone goes about their business working on, their pet interests. I think you need to bring people together, and there's a lot of work that goes into pulling all that together for a release. So it's a very useful tool, but I think that we're going to do our best to be quality-driven and not date-driven.
Sure. So moving forward after that 1.5 release, what can we kind of expect from there as far as the Mozilla Foundation, whether it be Firefox or Thunderbird, or kind of where's the focus going to shift?
So the focus for 1.5 is going to be a really high-quality Firefox and Thunderbird release. We'll also be previewing our Zool Runner platform, which is the set of features and code and libraries necessary to build Gecko-based applications, whether they be, you know, browser-like things or other services or other products entirely. And we'll have a preview release there. As soon as we branch for 1.5, as soon as we create our stable branch and move our final work up to that branch, the tip of the development trunk is going to open up to Gecko 1.9 work. And that's going to immediately see a bunch of new code landing, stuff that's been held up while we've been in the ramp down stage to 1.5. A lot of the things we're looking at there are behind the scenes, but are going to make for a really compelling set of applications and further, you know, sort of open up the content area to web application developers. So we're going to see a bunch of work going on with our core rendering technologies, moving more of our back end over to Cairo and getting vector graphics and hardware accelerated graphics into our core. We're going to see improvements in our APIs for developers building on top of the Gecko platform. We're going to see further improvements to our SVG support. I think we'll see the beginning of work on some of the other what working group tasks, including things like Canvas and web, the next generation web forms. In addition to that, some of the Mozilla features and some of the Firefox and Thunderbird and Mozilla features are going to be sort of pushed aside for a minute while we rebuild some infrastructure that they can be rebuilt on. One fine example is bookmarks in history, which currently live on a pretty old back end, and we'd like to move up to a new database, probably SQLite back end for all of our major stores, things like our storage for our bookmarks, our history, possibly our mail and Thunderbird and other things like that. And that new backend is going to really let us do a lot with improving the ability to manage that kind of data. Right now, bookmarks management and history management and mail management is a little bit harder than it needs to be because the backends are overly complex and we don't have a lot of people who understand them in our extension community, in our core development teams. So we're going to be doing a bunch of back-end work. And then we're going to start to see some exciting new features come out of that. We could see a radically overhauled history and bookmark system that replaces the whole paradigm that we have right now. I think we'll see a bunch of per website controls coming in so that you can really control what individual websites can and can't do. I can see us looking to some of the best-of-breed extensions to possibly integrate some of those the way we have with the tab drag-and-drop, which was a direct result of a very popular Firefox extension called Mini-T. We worked with that author to basically bring his code into the core Firefox project. It's one of those areas where it seemed like, you know, we had enough users who wanted tabs to behave this way, and it was something that wasn't going to get in the way of all of our other users, so we imported that code and worked with that developer to integrate it. So I think we'll see some more of that. I think you'll see us building out our support for RSS and feeds in general. I'd love to see us getting our live bookmarks to be a little more useful for sort of mom-and-pop users and introduce more of the world to getting notifications and headlines and things like that through RSS. I think we can do more to improve our handing off our RSS to other clients like Thunderbird or some of the other popular RSS readers out there. And then there's a whole bunch of stuff that we'll be working on, I'm sure, to integrate into better into the next generation of platforms. We've got Microsoft's Vista on the horizon, and you know, Mac is making some pretty serious moves with their hardware platform in the next year, and I think we'll want to be addressing those.
Okay. So you mentioned that you may integrate some of the top extensions. For your money right now, what's the best one or two extensions that you kind of have to have?
You know, I'm not a big... I really think that for the most part, Firefox works great out of the box. There are a few little tweaks that I wouldn't mind seeing. The tab drag and drop reordering seems like a useful thing to me. I used that for a little while. I actually worked with the author of that and helped him, contributed the little drop icon marker, that horrible little purple down pointing arrow was my artistic handiwork. I hope we replace that soon because it's not the best. But so I like that feature. I also really like there's a little extension that allows you to resize the search box, the Google and alternate search engine search box, to make it a little bit wider. I think something like that is a usability win, and it's not a new feature per se, but it improves an existing feature. There's another one I use pretty regularly that's called Text Area Resizer, and for anyone who does web publishing through a text area, like, you know, I publish to my weblog and I've got this simple little text box, and I can, with this extension, I can grab the corner of that text box and make it twice as wide or twice as tall without any difficulty, and I think that'd be a nice extension to integrate. I'm not a really big on power features, because even though I'm a power user, I think what we have with Firefox is really quite capable now, and I don't want to see us adding so many features that the ones that are most important get buried. But some of these little enhancements are quite nice, and I think the ones that proved to be really useful, we will look at integrating them. But outside of those sort of polished and enhancement features, I'm not a big extension person. I love it. I love watching the extension community grow. We've, you know, got about 700 of these extensions out there, and I've tried probably every single one of them. And a lot of them have some really nice ideas, and I think we ought to be paying close attention, because it's an area of innovation that we can participate in and fuel and reap benefits from, I think, unlike any other software project out there.
Right. It allows the people that want to have more, but to kind of keep the core fast, functional, and useful, which is nice.
I said this when we were talking up at GnomeDex, and I don't know whether I'll be able to, you know, to sustain this, because I'm not the person sort of, you know, leading all of the product decisions. But in my mind, a really successful release would be one where we removed a feature, something that was getting in the user's way or causing them to have to jump through unnecessary hoops. Mm-hmm. I'm not a minimalist by any means, and I'm not sort of a lightweight browser user, but I want things to be easy and quick and do what I want them to do without me having to jump through a lot of hoops. And the more we can do that, I think the more widespread adoption we'll see of Firefox. You really have to make it, you know, you have to make it better and more functional, but you also got to make it easier to use. And I think that's been a focus in the Firefox world, is to try to take those features that most people need and polish them up or lean them down in such a way that the user doesn't have to think about using them. There are a few exceptions. For example, tabbed browsing. When we created Firefox, tab browsing, and we didn't say, hey, that's a power feature, let's toss it over. We said, how can we make tab browsing something that's more accessible to regular people? And we trimmed down the feature set for tab browsing, and we cleaned up how you create tab groups and tried to make it all a little bit less complex. And I think that really helped us put tab browsing in the hands of a whole bunch of users who never would have seen it or even been able to understand it in the old implementation.
Right. One small thing I always bothered me about the tabbed implementation, and I haven't checked the very latest version, so maybe it's fixed, but if you have no tabs open, you can't right-click and say new tab. You have to have at least one open.
Yeah, so again, we are, you know, a software project in development, and I would just comfortably and casually call that a bug. We have a number of things that we need to do to continue to improve the usability of tabs. There is an ongoing debate about whether or not we want to make tabs very visible to every user, considering that we believe that only about a third of our users are using tabs.
Really?
I believe if we made them even better, if we could improve their usability, we might see half of our users using tabs. But there are a large group of people out there who simply don't need them and won't use them. I know, for example, I was talking with my wife's parents about their browsing habits. Open one window, check their webmail, close it down, and that's what they do on the web. And so they don't need a bunch of tabs because they're not trying to manage, you know, sort of the complex desktop we are. And I would like lots of those people who really, you know, don't need the power environment to use Firefox, and I don't want to overwhelm them with features that they don't need and won't use. So we have this debate about how much of it to expose in the case where it's not a tab browser user. And that debate will go on, and we're always listening to feedback. Unfortunately, the feedback is, as it is the case with most open source projects, tends to lean heavily toward power users because those are the people who are willing to take the time to give you that feedback and the ones who are, you know, willing to come in and file bugs and participate in your development project are generally not sort of mom-and-pop regular people users. And so we're reaching out and trying to find new ways to get feedback from those less savvy users so that we can do a better job of taking their needs into account. I know that the debate about whether or not we should show the tab strip when you only have one browser content experience going has been ongoing since, you know, before Firefox was born. And then how much do you expose of the new tab and open a new tab and all of that UI to users who may not need it? Then it's just getting in their way. So we do have a long ways to go. I said also at GNOME Dex, I don't think that, you know, that Firefox is great. I think it's just better than the others, and it makes a lot of users less scared about going online. And if we can get to a point where I feel like and the world feels like we've got a great browser, that would be wonderful. I think we have some big, you know, hurdles to overcome before we're there because we're just less worse than the others right now. And I hope that as we, you know, get 1.5 out the door and start looking toward 2.0 and 3.0, that we'll start making some of these sort of big leaps that we need to in usability and functionality that will make it so that I can say with confidence we're a great browser, not just we're better than the other guys or we make the web suck a little bit less.
There's a new tagline for you.
Yeah, it is. You know, it is interesting because I think that one of the problems, and especially in open source development, is we get very focused on our habits and how we use the software, and we build it to work for us. And in many cases, it does work for us. So I can look at Firefox and say, this is great for me. This is the best browser on the planet. I love it. It works perfectly for me. It's excellent. But it's not yet excellent. It's just excellent for me. My big goal is to try to find out what is the rest of the world need from this product, and is it excellent for them? And then, is there a way to pull it off? Can you make a single application that is really usable for, you know, a wide range of users? And I think that's one place where our extension architecture has really helped. It relieves us of the burden of satisfying most of our power users with an out-of-the-box experience that suits them, because if they need more features, they can go find those and install them. And they're the ones that are capable of finding and installing new features. At the same time, we can ship something that's clean and simple and I think easy enough for those who don't want a powerful, you know, extremely featureful, but still need a capable and better web experience. So the extension model has really helped us there, in addition to the point I mentioned earlier about it being a wonderful proving ground for new features and a great experimental space. It certainly has freed us up to ship something that I think is suitable to a much larger audience than our development community and our primary feedback and testing communities.
Right, yeah. I mean, you mentioned it at GNOME Dex and kind of mentioned it quickly just now, but I think we all do forget that the people who are filing bug reports and definitely feature requests are in no way indicative of the average user, because the average user wouldn't even know where to find Bugzilla, and if they did, would have no idea how to use it.
Yeah, and so, you know, we face open source projects, and certainly Firefox, because that's the one I'm heavily involved with, face this challenge of how do we get that kind of feedback. And in the last year, we've put some new tools into place in the Firefox and Mozilla world to try to reach beyond our traditional world of coders and bug reporters. The first tool to come online was one called Hendrix. And Hendrix is a simple feedback mechanism. It's nothing exciting. But when you go to Bugzilla's front page, it basically says, are you about to file a bug report, something technical that our developers can use, or do you want to just let us know something, give us some general feedback about the product? And if they're the feedback type person and not the bug type person, they can type up their information into a little form and it submits to a news group that we sort of skim through and collate certain areas where people seem to be commenting a lot and go through and try to improve those. That was a step that I think helped us lower the barrier to feedback, given that Bugzilla is a complicated beast to work with. Yeah. Another area that we're working now is a tool that we've recently included in the Firefox Alpha releases called Reporter. And Reporter is available from the help menu in recent Deer Park Firefox 1.5 alpha builds. And what that does is if you visit a website and the website doesn't appear right or doesn't work right or blocks you or anything like that, with the simple click of that menu item, you get a little reporter wizard that pops up and helps you tell us about that problem site. And then we can look at those in aggregate and figure out whether it's a bug in Firefox or something the website needs to improve. And so this is something that, you know, lowers the barrier to entry again so that we can get feedback from a class of user that we weren't before, because previously we sort of required they jump through the hoops of Bugzilla. I want to see us in doing even more in this area. Spread Firefox is another place where we've reached a class of user who aren't necessarily the developers and the testers. A lot of these people are, you know, regular users who just want to spread the word. We have a lot of sort of marketing professionals and people in advertising and PR, and these are not your traditional early adopters who are going to go into Bugzilla. And so we're gathering a new level of feedback from those people. I'm going out on the street and talking with people who use other browsers, who use our browser, and saying, you know, what works for you and what doesn't. And I think that we need to, you know, we really need to expand and do large-scale usability testing with a much less sophisticated audience. I think most of the people who listen to this program would be really surprised if they sat down and watched a few regular people be asked to go through some basic browser tasks. I've sat in some of these usability studies, and I don't want to put anyone down. It's really the developers who ought to be, you know, a little bit ashamed when they watch these. And you can see, you know, a usability study where you ask this subject, this participant, you know, can you tell me what you would do to mark this page so you could go visit it again tomorrow, you know, and watch them struggle with basic things like bookmarks or favorites. It's not that users are dumb or that they can't learn, but we have made things unnecessarily complex in so many ways, and I think that one of the goals of software producers has to be to make software easier to use, because regular people don't look forward to troubleshooting their applications. I think we do. This is something I was about to blog about today, and that is that I came to the office today, and we've got a new office manager at the Mozilla Foundation, and her computer wasn't connecting to the wireless network. And that was a challenge for me. I sat down with her, and we started to troubleshoot it. And I had a good time spending 30 minutes figuring out how to get her machine to connect. Most people aren't like that. We're odd. We're kind of strange that we enjoy some of these technical challenges. But I think the regular people out there, they want it to work. And if they get it working, they don't want to touch it. They don't want to break it. They don't want it to stop working. But we have to find ways to make it so that it works for them better out of the box. They don't have to configure something that could have been configured for them. So they don't have to learn a new feature that could have just worked the way they expected it to work. And that is a huge challenge, and it's what we've been focused on with Firefox for the last, you know, almost 3 years now. And I think that we're making progress. But, yeah.
Right. You had mentioned earlier that, you know, the Google toolbar now supports Firefox. I know the Yahoo toolbar also does. And recently, I think Yahoo announced that their desktop search supports Thunderbird. Do you see more of this where applications will supporting Firefox?
Oh, no doubt. I mean, we started seeing this with probably the 0.8 release of Firefox. This is, you know, back when we had first, you know, coined our final name, Firefox, and moved from our previous Firebird name. There was a whole bunch of enthusiasm, and immediately we started seeing reports of people saying, I've made my web application work in Firefox. I've made, you know, my blog page render correctly in Firefox. And there was this enthusiasm to support Firefox and Gecko like I hadn't seen in the previous, you know, 4 or 5 years with Mozilla. By the time we got to 1.0, it was clear that some of the big players were coming on board. We started seeing regular press announcements for various pieces of software that now include Firefox support, and you know, the big search guys coming on with Google and Yahoo to build both toolbars and desktop search that integrate and work well with Firefox and Thunderbird is something that is, you know, it's only going to continue. I think that the next big hurdle we have is trying to get enterprises to start building their internal services to support Firefox. We got a big boost in this front when IBM announced, I guess it was about a month ago, I've been so busy I can't tell you if it was a month or 6 months, but recently in the past IBM announced that they were going to train their tech support people and convert their internal applications over so that Firefox would be a supported platform for their, you know, 200,000 or whatever it is employees. And that's big. They have, you know, applications for handling expense reports, for handling, you know, payroll, for handling all kinds of office supply requests. I mean, everything you would need to do in a large business to communicate on an intranet is an application that was probably designed to work for IE, and IBM made the commitment to turn all of that around and make it cross-browser. And I figure, you know, they're big and they've got a lot of resources, but they're going to be an inspiration, I think, to other organizations that if a company with as much going as IBM had going can convert their internal applications to work with Firefox, then there's absolutely no reason that a lot of other shops couldn't do the same. So I see this just continuing. Every exciting new application that I see released, whether it's a web-based application or a client-based application that interfaces with the web, is now advertising Firefox or Thunderbird support. That's just great.
Oh, yeah. The one thing that I always wondered about the Google toolbar is why it didn't support Firefox sooner, considering they employed multiple Firefox developers.
I don't know because I'm not privy to Google's, you know, product line information, but Google's been a very supportive organization from, you know, from very early on in Mozilla's history. We had people at Google who would, you know, file good bug reports on us and help narrow down the problem and why their page wasn't rendering correctly and then Mozilla builds. And we've just had a good relationship with them and Yahoo as well. I think that one of the things that happened was very early on, a Google toolbar created by the Mozilla open source community was developed and became highly popular for Mozilla and then Firefox. And so there wasn't any real pressure to have a formal one because these informal ones were doing a... Then when we shipped Firefox and our final sort of feature set included Google search right in the URL bar along with, you know, Yahoo search, Amazon search, and a few others, it didn't seem quite as necessary as the Google toolbar did for IE users. Additionally, the Google toolbar for IE had other features unrelated to search. They blocked pop-ups, right? And that's got to be the reason that so many people on IE downloaded the Google toolbar was because pop-ups were a menace, and the best way to get rid of them on Windows, and if you're an IE user, is the Google toolbar. Firefox and Mozilla have blocked pop-ups out of the box without any modification for years. Nice. So that piece of feature wasn't, you know, really critical to Firefox users, and there wasn't the same sort of demand from the Firefox user base. On top of that, Firefox was a much smaller user base, no doubt. A year ago when we were approaching our preview release, we had a few million users. And that's not an audience that's necessarily worth targeting with a huge project. And if there's a lot of coding involved, then I can understand, you know, websites and businesses and other software applications, you know, not having the resources to target a platform that small, however much I want them to. Firefox, when it started getting some significant market share, when we started seeing numbers come out saying that, you know, we had tens of millions of users, that we were approaching the 10% mark, changed a lot of things, and I think that, you know, market share will help you with all of those other problems. You have to do, you know, the two at the same time. You have to get some of those apps to support you so that you can get some market share, and when you get some market share, I think more of those apps will come online with support. It's sort of a chicken and egg, and somehow Firefox has, you know, managed to work that out pretty well, so that we got a little more support from websites and application vendors, and we got a few more users, and they sort of played off of each other. And I think that it was really valuable that big players like Google and Yahoo and Microsoft were willing to come in when we were just a 1.0 product and start publicly announcing serious levels of support for our applications. It can only help.
Yeah, and kudos to Google. Even after they released the official toolbar, there still is a link to the open source one, so they're kind of leaving that choice there, which is awesome.
It was kind of a surprise to me. I didn't know they were going to be releasing it until they announced to the MozDev Google toolbar open source group that it was coming. And, you know, I think that those people did some great work. They put together a toolbar on their own with some input from some of the engineers at Google who were friendly on that list, but pretty much on their own, built one of the most popular Firefox toolbars.
Right.
And I think that, you know, there are a number of people who still prefer that toolbar to the one that Google ships because it offers a couple of features that the official Google toolbar doesn't. And I think Google understands that. And I think Google, doesn't want to come in and stomp all over a little open source project, but they did want to make, I think, the toolbar that more and more Firefox users were asking for.
Right.
And you know, like you said, kudos to them for keeping a link up to that and for, you know, for making it making Firefox a priority as well as some of the Firefox open source community.
Yep. Switching gears a little bit, IE7 is barely a speck on the radar, and it's already come under quite a bit of fire, from its tab browsing implementation to its XP and above only release target. What are your thoughts on IE7, and specifically, how do you think that it's going to impact Firefox?
That's an interesting question. It is hard to speculate on what, you know, a new product coming into your market is going to do. I made some speculation to a reporter from ZDNet UK a little while ago in an interview that went on for hours and hours, and that seemed to have sort of jumped out and become an article on its own. And I do believe that there are going to be a lot of people on Windows 98 and Windows 2000, and even some on Windows XP pre-Service Pack 2, who don't have any desire to move forward to Service Pack 2 or to Vista when it comes out. And a lot of these people have enough invested and have a solution that's working pretty well for them now, except for their web browser. And if they don't move forward and they feel like in order to move forward, they're going to be charged for an entirely new operating system, I think a lot of those people will start looking for, you know, a better alternative, how to improve their online experience. And so I'm hopeful that we'll see a big growth spurt in terms of, you know, Windows 98 and Windows 2000 users. And the two of those groups seem to make up about half of the Windows users out there today. So it's a non-trivial number, right? I mean, we're talking hundreds of millions of people who are still using Windows 98 and mostly Windows 2000. And there's no reason that we shouldn't target those users. As far as criticisms of the IE products, you know, I got to meet the team working on IE and even a couple of the Longhorn people up at Gnomedex, and maybe you did too. And these are good people.
Yep.
They want to build a good product. I mean, this is one of those things where, you know, it's easy to look at, you know, something big and say, you know, it's all bad. I hear from my friends in Europe, America's all bad. And then they meet some Americans and they're like, you know, how come you're not bad like America is or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is sort of the same thing, right? I mean, Microsoft it's a massive organization. They have, you know, a business sort of strategy that I don't particularly like and that I think I'm working for something that operates very differently than theirs. But the folks working on those products are good people. They have some challenges that we don't face. They have a huge installed base that is very difficult to support and maintain when you're making radical changes to the product. And this is, I believe, the decision to make IE7 for XP and forward users only, because they probably couldn't make it work very easily for all of their Windows 2000 and Windows 98 users, not without either great cost or a bunch of, you know, sort of backward compatibility fixes. And so they decided to leave, you know, a few hundred million users hanging out like that. And I think Firefox can fill that void and help, you know, in some ways help Windows users not have to continue with that vendor lock-in and be forced into an OS upgrade. At the same time, I expect IE7 will be a good browser. I think that Vista, formerly Longhorn, will be a good platform. And I look forward to building Firefox for Vista users and having a really killer experience there. I expect there are going to be things I wouldn't have done in IE7. I hear their tab implementation was sort of forced by a bunch of existing browser helper objects and toolbars to be, you know, a little bit less usable than, for example, I think ours is.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect that they're going to have some exciting new features in there. I'm real interested in their sort of lower rights model for IE7 under Longhorn, but I don't know that that's going to even be available in the IE7 for XP.
Okay.
I should know a little more. I think I'm going to be a beta tester for those guys, so I should be seeing something in the next day or two and have a little better idea of what they're doing there. But, you know, I think this is a space with a lot of people who want a better product. There are millions and millions and millions of people who curse their computers every day. And what I'm doing and what we're doing with Firefox is trying to, you know, make that a better day for these people, make their experience less painful. And I believe that the people on the IE team are doing the same. There may be business groups above them who have different reasons for making IE7, but the people actually working on it are good folks. They're trying to build a good browser that people will want to use. And I look forward to, you know, I look forward to seeing what they've done and seeing if there's things that we might do differently. And I've no doubt that Firefox has been some influence on them. I don't think that absent Firefox and tab browsing and pop-up blocking, we would have ever seen that happen in the Windows world. So I think, you know, we may be able to look at some of their work and take some influence from them. We just have to wait and see. But sure, anything that makes more people on this planet happier with their internet experience, I think, is a positive, because the internet is a phenomenon that is changing the planet and for the better. And the more we can get people hooked into it and using it and being able to improve their position in life through internet access, the better. If IE7 helps those people out, then great.
Yeah, I have my huge doubts about Vista or Longhorn, whatever they want to call it. But I have to agree with you. Every time, or at least almost every time, I meet a Microsoft employee, is a very smart, very enthusiastic person with a ton of insight. And it surprised me, like the first couple of years I went to conferences to meet Microsoft employees that were just so motivated, so intelligent, and so driven. And now I kind of take it for granted. And I guess for a lot of people in the Linux world, especially, that may not have necessarily met Microsoft employees, it's easy to hate the company, but once you meet the people, they really are good people.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, that's important. That's one of the things that I appreciate about the new movement towards sort of public faces through weblogs and things like this, is that, you know, I get to meet Robert Scoble, and I get to meet folks from the IE team and see that these are good folks. You know, right. they're hardworking, they're smart, and they care about what they're doing. You know, this just wasn't happening a few years ago, and I think that we get to take advantage of some of this, and we should. The up in the business levels who don't quite know what's going on down with the troops who are blogging now, mm-hmm. they may discover at some point in the not-too-distant future that we're all being friendly with each other, and they may sort of change course. But right now, we're getting a chance to communicate with each other at a level of detail and familiarity and views into each other's lives and products that's just unprecedented, and we should all appreciate that and take advantage of it. So,
oh, absolutely.
Big piece of what I do in my time online is reading about other projects that are interesting to me and the people who are working on them, and you know, and I think that's just wonderful. The more we do that, the more we'll be able to sort of treat each other as humans, and the more we'll be able to exchange good ideas for improving everything we're working on.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I recently sent you some browser statistics for LQ itself, and I lumped Mozilla and Firefox together. They came out at 57.7%.
That is so sweet to hear.
IE came out at 27.9%, so considerably lower. And I'll let the listeners go. You can go to Linux or jeremy.linuxquestions.org for the full stats. I listed about the top 10, I think it was. So are you getting reports from other technical sites that show this kind of lead for Firefox? I mean, obviously,
yeah,
that's not indicative
actually,
of regular.
It's real interesting, and I follow this way too closely and much more closely than I should, because you know, statistics. We don't have to go into, you know, how you can look at that or how you can't. But it's interesting to me, and I follow one number. I like to follow the trends. So starting about Firefox 0.8. started making enough of a dent that Firefox was showing where, or just Gecko wasn't, and we're starting with technical sites to move into the, you know, 5%, 7%, and 10% range, where Gecko has always been, even among the technical elite, stuck in the low single digits. Mm-hmm. So Firefox started getting its own listing in website statistics at popular tech sites. And I started to follow weblogs. A lot of weblogs share, you know, SiteMeter or one of these tracking tools and make their stats publicly available. Mm-hmm. And so right before the preview release of last year, I went and found some list of the top 100 weblogs and went and checked all of their stats and was amazed that when I averaged them up, they came to, like, you know, 25%. Whereas our mainstream stats were showing, you know, 5% or 3% or something like that. And, you know, that made me feel really good. Among the people who are sort of out there using the web, and bloggers and blog readers, I think, are a little more, they're spending a little more time online and using the web a little more than to see before we even shipped Firefox 1.0 that we had a non-trivial number of users out there was really quite exciting.
Yeah.
Then I started to blog some of those statistics, and more sites, either other weblogs or tech journals or even some big newspaper sites like, you know, Heise.de, and especially in Europe, but all over the globe, started publishing or emailing me some of their stats. And I started to see, you know, numbers in the 30s and 40s, and that's pretty exciting around the, you know, the post 1.0 release times. Recently, I did another one of my polls of the top 100 websites and averaged out the statistics there. I did, you know, several polls during different times of the day across the site meter rankings. And it seemed that the number tracked pretty closely with what boingboing.net has for usage statistics. And I did this a second time, and it seemed to track again. So I think that I'm now just using BoingBoing as a proxy, and I think that Firefox is about 40% of blogs out there. Of wow. popular weblogs, the readership is about 40%. So that means that, you know, we are reaching sort of early adopter and heavy web user audience much more effectively than we're reaching the regular audiences, where the numbers, I think, overall are around 10 or 15% in Europe. But certainly it's great to hear. A site that does movie theater ticketing just sent me some stats a couple of weeks ago, and they had the 52% and said, you know, this is great, you're over 50%. And that's really exciting to me. I think
that's awesome.
You know, we ought to find some mechanism to aggregate all of this, maybe a Spread Firefox project, to get a good view of different segments of the market based on popular websites for those consumers and what stats they're reporting on Firefox. But I have no doubt that we are going to be a player in this industry for quite a while. There is, you know, and we're going to, especially with the early adopter community, we're going to see Firefox just take that world by storm. 50% and 60% is happening now, and I think in the next year with Firefox 1.5 getting out there and reaching a whole new batch of people, mm-hmm. we're going to see sites like Linux Question jumping up to the set. I want 75% real quick.
All right, I'll keep you informed on that one.
Looking forward to it.
So now probably a topic that everyone's been waiting for, which was your recent comments about Linux on the desktop. The blog post that got slash-dotted and kind of sparked the big debate was called Linux Not Ready for the Desktop. And kind of ironically, I think you and I had kind of discussed this at length at GnomeDex a little bit before you blogged that. But in the blog, you kind of brought out four main areas, and they were migration, API stability, simplicity, and comfort. If you could, why don't you go over your kind of thoughts on, you obviously think that it isn't ready yet, at least from the post, and kind of just give us an idea of why you think that.
All right. Well, it is the case that our discussion inspired a piece of this. A lot of discussions I had with people at GnomeDex, you know, really got me charged up and defending Firefox's position for being sort of a clean and simple yet powerful tool that would bring sort of a better experience to users without overwhelming them. And, you know, I spent a fair amount of time espousing that Firefox had made a good move to clean up and simplify its interface and was, you know, you and others about how, you know, Linux could benefit from some of these same kinds of maneuvers. And so I got back, and then I read this article about, you know, Firefox and Tux Mini and how it was ready for the desktop, and all it needed was some hardware vendor support. And I think this is, you know, the sort of the classic argument that I've been seeing with Linux for 2 or 3 years now is it's all about drivers and hardware support and getting shipped by Dell, right? And when you're shipped by Dell, you're a success. Well, the same argument was going on back in the Mozilla world. You know, we had people with the release of Mozilla 1.0 saying, yeah, but we're going to be stuck at 2 or 3% until we ship on the desktop, until Compaq and Dell and all those guys ship Firefox icons on the desktop. We're never going to get anywhere because you can't compete until you're shipped on the desktop. Your icon is shipped on the desktop. And it turned out that it was a really difficult thing to convince Dell and Hewlett-Packard and IBM to put Firefox on their desktop rather than IE that was already there. And we just didn't make a lot of progress on that. So we had to turn to different methods. We had to say, well, maybe they'll listen to us when we get some more market share. So, hey, let's get some market share where we can. And Firefox was born out of a desire to achieve mainstream uptake and to get some real usage from the masses. And we followed a basic plan. We said with Firefox, you know, we're going to make it really, really easy for people to try it out, to get on it. Then they're going to be hooked by a couple of these really cool features, and they won't want to go back to IE, right? Mm-hmm. The second thing we were going to do is, hey, let's make it so that when they get it, and when they get, you know, a plugin working on it, that doesn't break when they upgrade. When they get it and they visit a website that was working really well, that doesn't break when they upgrade Firefox, and that they can count on, you know, a certain level of stability, API stability or stability of experience with the content that was showing up in Firefox. And then, you know, the third key area was get rid of all of this stuff that we put into Mozilla. That we put it in because we were prepared to make a decision about what the right thing to do was. So we made it a preference. Let's let every user pick for himself what the right thing is. You know, that we were willing to accept almost any feature that was well coded. It could, if you, you know, this is open source. If you've got an itch, you can scratch it. Write up a patch and get it reviewed and check it in. And so we said, let's get rid of that stuff and let's make some hard choices. Do most people need it to do it this way or that way? And let's just do the right thing for most people and not force everyone to pick, because people don't like configuring software. They really don't. We're different in that area. We love going in and turning all of the knobs and tweaking all of the levers. But most people, I don't think, really enjoy that. So we said, let's just simplify. Let's figure out what are the features people need to use to browse, and then what are the few features that we want to give them that make it better. And let's really polish those up and make them easy. And then the final thing we did was, let's make it comfortable. There were some really funny discussions in the Mozilla world in this area, right? We had things like in Mozilla, to use the keyboard to focus the address. The shortcut was Control L. Mm-hmm. L focuses the address bar and lets you type in a new address. IE, the shortcut was Alt D. Mozilla refused to change it from Control L to Alt D because Mozilla was targeting communicator users who had years of experience using Control L. Fox, we said, hey, unused, let's just do them both. And now IE users will have a real comfortable time move over, doing something they've been doing for years and years and developed good habit and muscle memory and all of that around. And so we said, let's make it comfortable. It doesn't have to be a clone. It doesn't have to have everything exactly the same way. But where it's an easy decision to make it comfortable for them or not make it comfortable for them, let's make it comfortable. And so these things, I think, are the keys that really helped Firefox achieve success. And when I sat down after coming back from Linux World and after reading this Tux Mini article, you know, in Tux Mini, he's making the same argument we did. We got to have support from the OEMs before we're ever going to get market share. And I just don't buy that anymore, because Firefox was able to get market share and then get support from the big guys. Google and Yahoo and IBM, they weren't supporting, you know, Firefox when it was, or Mozilla when it was brand new, with huge pieces of software support and internal deployment and things like this. But once we got a certain amount of market share, they started looking at us differently. And so then I said, well, what do we do if we can't count on the OEMs to help Linux get out on the desktop? If we don't see a Tux Mini or Dell shipping, Ubuntu to tens of millions of users every week or whatever, well, let's try to get the market share first and see if the hardware and OEM vendors will follow. What do you do to get some market share from regular people? Right. Linux has a huge following in academia, in software development world, in places, in, you know, back-end servers, but where they're not targeting the biggest possible market. The biggest possible market is Windows users, regular people. If you do a little bit of for those people, you'll get some pretty serious numbers. How do you get them to come over? And I started thinking about the things that Linux always felt a little, you know, odd to me or hard for me to deal with. And I realized that they fell into basically the same set of categories, right? I mean, people can't easily migrate to Linux. They can't easily test it out, get going on it, a feature that hooks them and stay. Well, I'm not saying strip Linux down to its most basic. I'm saying make it really easy to migrate to. And there are ways to do this, right? I mean, carry over settings for popular applications like Firefox and the Office software so that when they sit down at Linux and they fire up something that's sort of a replacement for their old Windows application, it works and feels like it used to. Make keyboard shortcuts work for them. Make it comfortable so they don't have to learn something new. Then the second thing is, you know, make it so that they can, you know, that they can go out and find a new piece of software and install it easily and not have to learn a new paradigm for that. If they hear Firefox made a new release, they should be able to read the Firefox web page, download and install. Take decisions away from the user. Linux and our community of developers and open source people love choices. We want to give everyone a choice on everything. We have 50 million preferences for a simple text editor. Take some of those choices away because simplicity has a huge value for people. So I suggested that we, you know, not offer so many choices. One of those areas that's really painful is Linux itself. Which distribution? There are hundreds out there. Even if you narrow it down to the top four or five, that's still four or five choices. Do I want Ubuntu or do I want Linspire? Do I want, Red Hat or on SUSE, you know, and so I think all of these choices are enough to make someone say, well, I'll come and look later. If they pick one, say they go get Fedora and they install it and they finally made a decision. On first launch, now it's going to ask them, do you want KDE or GNOME? I mean, you know, another choice that they really don't need and don't want to be making. Give them the thing that you think will work best for them. Then they get it open and they've got a choice of five different apps to play music on. I mean, which one do I use? This idea that choice is good has really, I think, gone just overboard on a lot of places in open source applications and the open source desktop. So I think that it's a really good idea for a few distributions to tackle or try to tackle this problem by removing a bunch of the choice, by making it really easy to migrate, by making it really easy to upgrade and to get new applications, and then by making it feel good. Just give the user something that they're comfortable with, especially if it's easy to do and doesn't cost you anything. You know, there's no point in trying to force someone to learn something new if they're not going to dramatically benefit from it, because they are going to lose their habits and their experience and their comfort level. So I wrote up those 4 points, and I no doubt was not convincing in my premise that I don't hate Linux and I don't want to turn it into a Windows clone. And so I got all of the feedback I guess could be expected, and that led me to decide I'm going to do a series of follow-up posts where I break each of these down and try to further explain to people that I don't hate Linux. I don't want it to be a Windows clone. I want it to be successful. I want it to grow market share, because I think the more pressure we put on Microsoft and Mac and the more opportunities we give people for an improved experience is better. And so I put a little bit of time into trying to communicate that, and it seems to have, you know, stirred up more sort of defensiveness and anger than I expected. But I'll continue, because I think that it is important that we start looking at, you know, how do we achieve the next level when we don't have the OEM and hardware support. I mean, you know, Mozilla didn't give up and walk away when we realized we weren't going to be distributed on Dell's desktop. We found another way into the market that was through slowly but surely finding ways to win over millions of users.
And I don't think the Linux community is going to give up in any way. And that's one of the reasons that I wanted to have you on the show, is I think sometimes as a community we can kind of be a little bit averse to criticism, and especially because I think we take so much undue criticism that when constructive, valid criticism comes, it's some kind of pushed down with the FUD.
And I can completely empathize with that. You remember I was working on Mozilla for, you know, 4 years before Firefox was even born, and there was no bastard stepchild in the open source world that was more criticized than Mozilla, and much of it fairly so. We were much slower back in the old days. We were overcomplicated in the old days. We were hard to migrate to in the old days. All the things that I think we have improved with Firefox were real issues, and they're better now. And because they're better. And because we were able to call out the positive and useful criticism from the "it's not Microsoft, it sucks" criticism, I think we were able to make some important and effective changes. I also want to say that it's not that all of this stuff isn't being worked on. I'm not putting down on the work that a lot of people have done to try to improve in these areas. And I'm not saying that Linux has to overtake Microsoft or it needs to be appeal to everyone. But I am saying that these are areas from my experience that Linux needs to improve in it if it wants to see more users and it wants to see them in any significant way while this wonderful window of opportunity exists. We don't yet have Microsoft's next generation platform sort of taking back the spotlight. There's a wonderful opportunity in the next year for Linux to make some big gains. I hope that projects like Ubuntu and companies like Linspire continue to try to make a distribution that's really useful for regular people. Ubuntu is my favorite so far, and I neglected to say that in the original article, but I've been using it on and off since it came out, and their approach seems to be, you know, sort of on par with what I think it needs to be. They still suffer from some, you know, basic problems. Like, I think that, you know, regular people don't want to see Open Terminal as the first item on their context menu. Microsoft did a really smart thing in burying their console down under three levels deep on the start menu because, you know, most users are scared to death of, you know, that old DOS prompt that comes up when something bad happens. So I think there's still more to do, but I certainly didn't intend to say none of this was being done. I just wanted to point out that I think these are the necessary, though maybe not sufficient, conditions for more widespread adoption.
Sure. And I know you make a bunch of good points, and there's some that I definitely disagree with you on. And unfortunately, I don't think we'll kind of have time to go point by point because I know that you have a meeting that you have to catch. And there are a couple other things that I want to go over besides the Linux on the desktop conversation. I think
that's fair. A few more minutes.
The biggest point that I do disagree with is you mentioned that kind of you weren't able to get adoption from Dell and were able to get some market share and then get some attention after that. And with an application, I think that's a little bit more feasible. People are comfortable installing applications. They've done it for a long time, and over the life of their computer, they'll install many applications. Most Windows users, even after owning a computer for years and considering themselves maybe intermediate-level users, they've still never installed Windows even, let alone installing another OS. So I think from my perspective, for Linux to really get traction, I think that...
I totally agree with you. It is not comparable with installing an application. And that is one of the reasons that it has to be so much better than even Windows. Windows doesn't have to overcome itself. Linux, in order to get Windows users, is going to have to overcome Windows in some fairly tricky areas. And one of those areas could be making it really easy for people to be exposed to the benefits of Linux without risking their computer. And this is why I think that installing into a dual boot mode or some kind of, like, I think ideally what I would do is if I was trying to get my mom to use Linux, I'd set up VMware on her system and let her use Linux inside of that for a week, right? And she'd be able to, you know, to drag and drop documents from Windows in. But that's not really a viable solution here.
Or so something like some kind Nopix of is a good idea, too.
That does enough migration so that they'll get in there and use it for a few days, because I think a few days is enough that some of the cool features that Linux has, like multiple desktops. I love multiple desktops.
I don't know how Windows users live without that.
I never would have gone out and even thought to find an extension to Windows that gave me that until I used Linux. Okay. So I completely agree with you that it is a much more difficult task to get people to move over an entire OS than it is to move over an application, and that the comparison isn't fair to the difficult task that Linux faces. But I believe it's worth trying. I believe it can be done, and that we have to at least try to make some kind of migration experience work. And that if we can do that, if we can find some way to convince enough people to move over just to give it a try without risking their current OS. I mean, that means don't install on top of Windows, install beside it, and offer the user a very clean dual boot scenario. Right. And enough users will try it out and will get hooked on it. The same way when users tried out Firefox, they got hooked on it. IE was still there. We didn't override IE. They could still use it. It was still even easier to use because it was hooked into so many of the default systems tools that it made it really easy for people to fall back to it. But because Firefox was so sticky, because we had features they really fell in love with, a lot of them stuck it out. And I think that there are opportunities for Linux to do something similar. I may be proved wrong, and it may be that we simply have to wait for OEM distribution and big internal corporate deployment. But I wouldn't give up on that so easy, because I don't think it would be terribly difficult to take something like Ubuntu, install alongside Windows, be able to read Windows files, bring those in, and give the user a really comfortable experience. If nothing more, we would have a lot more people knowledgeable about what Linux was, even if they didn't stick with it. And that means that when it did become available on the Dells that ship a year from now or 2 years from now, they would say, yeah, that was a pretty interesting experience. It was just a little too hard because it didn't come with, you know, vendor support, or it didn't come as the sole OS on my machine. And I don't expect everyone to agree with me on all of these points either. I'll be tossing them out there at OSCON next week as part of a keynote I got invited to deliver there, and I'm sure I'll hear some more then. In the meantime, I'm doing this series where I try to go into a little more detail about each of these issues. And the feedback in my most recent few posts has been a lot better. There are a few people, though, that kind of scare me. I hear a lot of people out there saying in the Slashdot article and in my original article that Linux doesn't need more users, that Linux shouldn't try to change to get more users, that we're fine with the users we have now and we shouldn't try to appeal to a broader audience. And I think that's an attitude that kind of worries me because, you know, if Linux doesn't find a way to make some big gains the next year or two, I fear that it will get increasingly difficult as things like hardware-based DRM that's tied into the operating system and all of that happens. It's going to be increasingly difficult to get the market share that will prevent that kind of thing from happening. And so I hope that people, you know, can come together and say that, yes, we do want more people using Linux, and we want that to happen pretty quickly. And that was sort of the only piece of criticism that really bothered me, was the people saying Linux shouldn't try to achieve greater market penetration.
Right. And that's why I think, like I said, we are sometimes a defensive community, at least part of the community. But when someone who evangelizes open source for a living talks, it's clearly not like you're a Microsoft shill, or you know, you don't know what you're talking about, or you're against open source.
I appreciate you hearing that, because that's another area where a couple of people said things like, I hope your payoff from Bill Gates was worth it. I certainly want the open source ecosystem to thrive. You know, a rising tide lifts all boats. I feel like Firefox is helping to bring, you know, more people into the open source world. I hope that Linux will help grow the Firefox user base. And I think we need to be competitive, and that needs to happen, you know, while this window of opportunity exists. And I certainly am not, I am not a defender of the alternatives or a supporter of, you know, proprietary and closed source and vendor lock-in and all of that. So I'm glad that at least a few readers, and you included, you know, are not unaware of my open source underpinnings.
And so Linux aside for a second, what do you think other open source projects in general, especially applications as opposed to OS, could learn from the success of Firefox?
Well, maybe it's a good point to wrap up on, because I am running into my next meeting, but I think that there are a couple things. First and foremost, you need to have a good community. I really think that to achieve kind of mainstream penetration, you need to have a broad-based community that includes developers and testers and users and support groups and everything you can get for that community. It needs to be as built out as it can be, and not overly focused on the developers and not overly focused on the marketing, but it needs to be balanced and cover all of those areas. And I think that Firefox did quite a lot to try to lower the barriers of entry to people who weren't, you know, necessarily coders or even hardcore testers, but to try to bring in a community that could support a much larger user base. And that means you need things like, you know, open source marketing, because guess what? Me, I'm a tester, you know, I'm not a great marketer. And I need help in that area. Some developers, they're not great, you know, UI designers, and they need good help in the UI design. So fill out your community with good representatives of all of the areas that need that kind of attention. And then the second thing is, you know, you really, I believe, to be where success is defined as having a lot of people enjoy using your software, you really need to be in tune with your users. And this is something that we're not done with at Firefox and that we haven't been perfect about. But I will say from the very beginning, we have had in our manifesto and in our overriding goals to figure out what is best for the most users of our product and try to deliver that. So a real focus on the user and a real focus on your community. Find a way to blend those two and to fill those out well. I think that you'll have an open source project.
Great. And so one very quick last question is, if you couldn't use Firefox, what browser would you use?
I couldn't use Firefox, what browser would I use? Oh, geez. Safari would probably be my second choice, and it would probably be enough to convince me I didn't have Firefox to move over to the Macintosh platform.
Wow. All right. Well, thanks for taking time out of your schedule, and I know you have a busy day, and I know you're already late for a meeting, so thanks for taking the time to be on LQ Radio, and LinuxQuestions.org is actually a sponsor, a media sponsor at OSCON, so I'll be in the crowd during your talk. I look forward to it.
Hey, Jeremy, thanks for having me on. I hope that some of your listeners out there found this interesting, and they can, you know, flames, they can find, you know, my website, and so we can both read them.
All right, great. Thanks, Aza.